Go, Dog, Go is a classic children's book, and it's full of dogs. Big dogs, little dogs, black dogs, white dogs, driving cars, wearing hats, amazing hats, playing baseball, going to parties, but there's not much of a story. Mesner Puppet Theater is performing Go, Dog, Go this summer, but you know what else they're doing? The Tempest by Shakespeare. And that is a little different. The Tempest is all like, we are such stuff as dreams are made on and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Go, Dog, Go is more like one little dog going in, three big dogs going out, a red dog on a blue tree, a blue dog on a red tree, a green dog on a yellow tree. Here to talk to us about this dramatic range of summer shows is Mike Horner of Mesner Puppet Theater. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So first of all, I am so excited that you're doing Go, Dog, Go. What inspired that choice?
Well, it was actually my very favorite childhood book, and I found my copy, which I realized doesn't have a spine anymore, and it's got crayon all over it, but so I brought it in a plastic bag. But so it was my favorite book as a kid.
And why? Okay, are you able to articulate why? I know things you love as a kid, there's not much of a reason sometimes, but...
Oh, I think for me, I don't know, I think it was the illustrations, because, like you were saying, there's not much story, not much plot, not much going on there.
Just but, prepositions.
Yes, up, down, in, out, around. But if you look at the illustrations and P.D. Eastman, who wrote it and illustrated it, look at the faces of the different dogs. And you got to wonder, what else is going on there?
Totally.
Why are these dogs, three dogs coming out of this maze, why do they look so traumatized?
I agree. I have actually wondered that. Because I have to tell you, I read this book like almost every day right now. And there's a blue dog going into a maze and three...
Red dogs
coming out. The dog going in looks just fine, but the three dogs coming out, like they've seen something in there.
Something's going on in there. And you know, as a kid, I used to imagine that blue dog was going in, going shopping. It looks like she's got a shopping cart, the way her paws are. But but I don't know what the three dogs saw coming out. But
they have these like wide eyes.
They're traumatized. I don't know why. But yeah. It was the illustrations and just pouring over the pages, and then when you get to that dog party at the end, there's so much going on.
Yeah.
It just intrigued me.
And so reading this book with a little kid, that dog party, you can spend several minutes on that page just looking at what all the different dogs up in the tree are doing. They're like hands reaching out of the tree. They're passing around cake. There's a dog in a cannon, which is a little hard to explain.
There's dogs on trampolines. There's dogs somehow up in the sky. You just see their paws from, I don't know what they're doing up above the tree, but there's so much going on. And it's just, for a kid, it's just a magical double spread page.
Okay, before we move on to the puppet interpretation, one more thing about this book. There's this weird, the closest thing to a narrative in this book is the fact that these two dogs sort of repeatedly meet. One is a dog wearing a hat.
Yes.
She asks the other dog if he likes her hat, and he says no again and again and again. And then at the end of the book, he finally likes her hat. This is pretty weird.
It is strange. I mean, in a show, we would call that a running gag. You know, it's this thing that keeps coming back. You know, it builds every time in the book.
That last hat that he does like is crazy.
It's absolutely off the wall. There's fish hanging off of it. There's bones.
There's a mop.
There's a mop. There's a candy cane. So much is going on. But yeah, it's the classic running gag that builds. You know, each hat she tries, he doesn't like it. She tries something different. She keeps trying and trying. And finally, she has to go over the top to win this dog's approval, which is, it's not much of a plot, but it's something.
It's something. So, okay, how do you adapt something like this to make it a puppet show? Because the book reads like a set description, but something does have to happen.
Yes. And actually, just going back a little bit further with how we got permission to do the book, we did contact the P.D. Eastman estate directly and inquired if we could do our own adaption. And at that time, the rights were tied up with something and we couldn't. But we could get the rights to a script that already existed that a theater had put together and published. And so we could pay for the rights to get the license to use that script and then create our show on based on that. And what the original scriptwriters did, Stephen Dietz and Allison Gregory, they looked at the pages of the book and, like, on each page, for example, dogs at work. Work, dogs, work.
Yeah, they've got a jackhammer.
They've got a jackhammer. So they took that and then created a scene of dogs working with some wonderful music, composed some wonderful music that we were allowed to use. And that kind of, yeah, that becomes the whole show. And so we took what basically the stage directions that the script provided and acted them out with dogs, dog puppets. So there's a whole scene of dogs doing work. You know, the one comes out with the jackhammer, and on that one page where they're working, they're all digging. So that's all the page tells you they're doing, but you would assume if dogs are digging, it must be for bones.
Must be.
So our jackhammer...
The traditional method is to use paws.
Paws, but these are dogs in some weird dog society that that have tools, so they've evolved somehow. So we had our dogs digging up bones, and they acquire all these bones at the end and scoop them up in backhoes and construction equipment and haul them off.
Something else I have noticed as what would seem to me to be an obstacle is that these dogs are pretty much indistinguishable from one another other than being different colors. They are not what you would call characters.
Yes. And in some cases for us, that's a plus because we have four different sizes of dogs, dog puppets. And because the book, they're basically all the same dog, just with different colors, you know, we just had these four sizes of patterns that we just recreated in different colors of fabric. And so for us, that was a blessing. And but then it's in the performance that the puppeteers bring a little spark of personality to each dog. It doesn't have to be much.
Can you tell me about a dog personality that has really taken shape in the hands of a puppeteer?
Oh, well, let's see. Some of my favorite dogs in our version is there's these four dog acrobats that come out. And they're just a very floppy puppet on one stick. And there's two puppeteers, Amy O'Connor and Zachary York. And so they've each got one dog on a stick. They bring out these little floppy dogs. But when they're bouncing all together, you know, seeing four dogs move the same way is fun. But then they determine they're going to do some tricks. You know, they make a stack on top of each other and they do these acrobatic things. And the little dogs say, okay, well, I'm going to try this. Whoop! Another dog climbs out. Well, I'm going to try climbing. And the third dog, you know, he thinks about it and says, oh, I'm going to do this. And he crawls up underneath the whole stack. And so it's those little bit of sparks that you can add in. It doesn't have to be much, again. But it just adds a little something.
What is it like for you as an adult to be really investing your, you know, your fully developed creative energy around something that really you loved as a kid and related to in such a different way?
Well, I mean, for me, the book for me as a child was just joy. It's so much joy in it. And you can tell P.D. Eastman was just having fun doing those illustrations. And I think that translates as an adult creating the piece. That joy comes through, hopefully, to the audience. And I think it does. So you're just conveying the joy in the book through this physical object in a performance and hoping. And luckily, we've succeeded in spreading that joy. And you can tell from the kids' laughter of what these absurd dogs are doing that they're getting the joy, too.
As I mentioned, you're also doing The Tempest. And that's for Teen Fringe as part of the Fringe Festival?
Yes. Our artistic associate, Erica Baker, is leading that. And I'm not really involved with it. But yes, so she's working with the Teen Fringe a group from Heart of America Shakespeare, and they're kind of going to be, yeah, creating puppets. It's going to be an exploratory thing, centered around The Tempest. I don't quite know what's all going on with it, but I think it's, yeah, they're going to play and explore and see what they can do, combining puppets and actors, and should be really cool.
As far as that, just thinking about the range of stuff your company is doing with, like, the range from Go Dog Go to The Tempest, it seems like the challenges would be so different. But is there sort of like a continuity in that whole range of different shows you perform?
Oh, definitely. It's for us, it's using this very specific tool, which is this puppet, a physical object, to tell a story. And that's, yeah, no matter what we're doing for kids or adults or whole families, it's all about breathing life into this physical thing and encouraging the audience to buy into this illusion. I've heard this quote that I think it was a German puppeteer said something like, puppetry is something that works well when you simultaneously know it's an illusion, but forget and it's an illusion. You know, you can see the person operating this thing, but then you forget and you just focus on this object that's doing actions and emoting and acting. And you allow yourself to buy into this little reality.
So thinking about puppets in Teen Fringe, I guess I think like kids have just a really great ability to do what you're saying. And adults can choose to re-embrace that and buy in. I would say teenagers aren't known for their willingness to accept that the thing they can see isn't true, that's like, that, you know what I mean?
Oh, sure. I mean,
seems like a skeptical audience.
It could be.
A tough audience.
Yes, but I mean, teens are at that, with adults, often it's not until, later after your 20s that people will embrace puppetry and buy into it again. And there's that gap from childhood until that point where you kind of ignore puppets and don't want anything to do with, or, you know, they're not cool.
Right.
But luckily, I mean, Erica's really good working with teens at, you know, helping tap into that thing, remembering, you know, what you loved about it as a child, or because children do it naturally. They don't think they're doing puppets, but when they've got their cars or their, you know, Barbies or action figures and you're acting things out, that's basically puppetry. You're using an object to play and use your imagination.
Well, my corner of Mesner Puppet Theater, I'm so sorry. Old habits die hard. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Go Dog Go is running for another week, and The Tempest is coming up later this month as part of Teen Fringe. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now the Missouri State Fair is getting some love at the Dahm Museum in Sedalia with photographs by Matt Rayner, who spent 2017 as the artist in residence at the fair. He came away with a series of candid photographs, not of livestock, rides, or concerts, but the people who came to the fair. He's calling them fair pictures. Matt Rayner, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gina. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if does fair pictures, is there a double meaning there?
Yeah, there is. Of course, they were taken at the state fair, so only natural to call them fair pictures, but also because, I think it's a fair representation of the people of Missouri. And going back to, like, you know, the origin of the word, it means pleasing, attractive, and beautiful. And, I think I wanted to give everyone that I took pictures of that put them on an equal plane of being, you know, beautiful and fair.
Do you think that is not how, like, our culture is currently seeing them?
Yeah, I mean, at the state fair, there's people from all backgrounds coming together. So in a way, it's like very democratic, you know, it's equal, it's all, everyone's invited to participate. And so, you know, I tried to gather a group of people in these pictures that represents what I feel is Missouri. And so everyone's given the same sort of equal treatment.
One of my favorite pictures in this series is called Fair Twins, and it's got two women. They are very obviously twins.
Yeah.
And they're wearing matching shirts that have horses on them.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about these women, how you met them, how you, like, approached the taking of this photograph?
Sure. So what I did was I set up a white backdrop out in front of the fair, the art building at the fair, and it's sort of in a thoroughfare where people kind of go from building to building, looking at the exhibits. And, you know, I would just stop people along the way. And so I saw these twins and I was like, I really want to take their picture, and just started talking to them. And they, you know, it's interesting because they are twins. They look a lot alike, but there's definitely differences.
Yeah, I feel like I could tell these two women apart.
Yeah. And they're just like, that was on the first day of photographing. So it was kind of a lucky occurrence.
Did you talk to people about their stories and sort of what brought them to the fair? Like, did you get to know the people you photographed?
A little bit. It was kind of the hustle and bustle of the fair, the nature of it. Sort of, you know, people are going from place to place. So I didn't want to take up too much of their time. But yeah, I got to know where they were from in the state, or maybe they were out of state or out of country even, and sort of what they did that day, or like what was their favorite attraction or ride or food.
What is your own background with the state fair?
Well, I'm originally from Buffalo, New York, and I don't ever remember going to the state fair in New York. And when we moved here to Missouri, you know, we went to
When was that?
That's when I was 11, so quite a while ago. But my childhood memories of the fair were really great, you know, corn dogs, rides, games, and just sort of a lot of people and, you know, livestock. So I always felt it was a place to go to sort of celebrate the end of summer, too, because it's right before school starts.
When you went, I mean, I went to the Missouri State Fair when I was probably about that same age, about 11. Yeah. And I remember there was a part of the fair where there were like shows, or I don't know what you would call them, but like the headless woman. And
oh, yeah.
I don't mean to give anything away, but I mean, I'm pretty sure there was just a sheet over her head.
Right.
But then there was like, yeah, you could hear a voice and, you know, you saw the world's smallest horse.
Right.
As when you went for the first time, what was your impression of that kind of stuff?
Oh, you know, I think so at the Missouri State Fair, there's sort of the amusement park area. And then there's also all these different attractions like livestock. And, you know, I just remember a lot of the animals and but also just the amount of people there was, you know.
It's the size of the crowd.
The size of the crowd, right. And just sort of getting lost in that lights and the glimmer and the sort of people trying to make you play games and you know, win prizes, which are almost impossible to win.
But so what made you want to be an artist in residence at the state fair all these years later? Was it something about the fair itself that seemed like this was going to be, I don't know, an interesting place to return to and take a closer look at?
Definitely. I mean, I like taking pictures of people. And so, you know, if I hang out at the corner of my hometown, you know, I'm not going to get that many people walking by. But at the state fair, I get a lot of people. So it was a way to interact with many different types of people in one place. And, you know, I would, for many years before my artist in residence, I went to the fair and photographed. And so it was only natural, I think, to go there and just to sort of, you know, people say that they go there to sort of people watch and sort of just be a part of this bigger thing. And so that's what I enjoy about it.
There's a photograph in your series that's got, maybe he looks like he's about a teenager and he's holding a chicken.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about him?
Yeah. So, like I said, I was outside of the art building, and right next door was like a children's sort of story time little, they had hay bales set up and they would tell stories. And so this young man was sitting over with a chicken about to tell a story to some kids. And I said, "Hey, can I borrow you for a second?" And he said, "Sure." And came over. So he's holding this chicken that I believe was his. And, you know, it was just sort of this tender moment between, I mean, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's really interesting. Can you talk a little more about the tenderness that you picked up on? It seems like that is what you were inspired by. And that's what I see when I look at the photograph, is affection.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, with a lot of my pictures, and that one's sort of from the waist up, a lot of them are from the shoulders up, but the ones I got from the waist up usually involve something else, like a woman holding a baby, or a man who lost his arms, or, you know, this man holding a chicken. And so, you know, I just, as I'm taking this picture, you know, I'm thinking about, okay, how can I direct him in a way, or do I tell him to look over my shoulder, or look into the camera, or look right above the camera, to capture that sort of affection. And the way he was holding him, sort of, you know, sort of cradling in a way that shows care.
When you think about, I mean, what you were saying before about the idea of a fair representation of the people of Missouri, I mean, when people think of teenagers tending livestock, this photograph really brought me back to like sort of a Charlotte's Web type relationship between youth and the animals they work with on farms. And that's not, I don't know, I don't think that that's the popular perception of that relationship necessarily.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, right next door to the art building, there's the livestock building. So there's chickens and like the prize winning chickens and things. And so you get to see kids light up at all these different animals, and there's, you know, hundreds of them, but they're all taken care of. And, you know, that's sort of, the fair encourages that sort of relationship and sort of points it out that Missouri is really an agricultural state. And, you know, you get outside of the cities and it's all cornfields and cow farms and things like that. So.
Was there someone who you photographed who you think about a lot and who you feel like, man, meeting this person made me think about either Missouri differently or just touched me?
Yeah. So it's in the show. It's not on the website of the Dom, but if you go see the show, there's a young lady, young woman holding a baby. And I think about that picture a lot because she seemed very new to motherhood and has this really young, I mean, maybe few months old baby. And I like the way she's holding the baby. It's sort of, assured yet maybe not so experienced. And,
Told you that?
It was a warm day at the fair. And you know, he looked tired out and I think they were about to leave the fair anyhow, but, just her and sort of her sort of, I don't know that I just think back to like pictures of, you know, Jesus and Mary and sort of this tradition and painting of the mother and child. And so that was sort of something for me to connect with in art history, but also, you know, to bring it sort of more up to date and current.
Beyond the photographs that you created at the fair, how many days did you spend there?
So I only spent a total of 5 days at the fair this year. I'm going to go back this summer and take more pictures. But, you know, I spent from morning to night, and I even spent the night at the fair one night. So I woke up super early and walked around when there's no one there.
What was that like?
It was great. My daughter slept. There's a room in the art building where the artist in residence can stay. So my daughter spent the night with me. We woke up early and went and got, you know, eggs and pancakes in the morning and walked around and just sort of saw. It was kind of quiet. And then you start to see the people trickle in and the hustle and bustle begin. And it was really a great thing. The fair, to me, it's like it's just a place it's all about family.
What is it like though? I mean, with your focus on the people who come to the fair, being there before anyone else arrived must have been really strange for you.
Yeah, it was, you know, you get to see behind the scenes a little bit and the people who work the fair and get to know them.
Did that reveal to you something you hadn't thought about before?
Well, you know, the people who do the amusements, they go from fair to fair. And so like, they're only here for a short time. But I guess just the tradition, it revealed the tradition, because the place we got breakfast at it's always there and it's been there for, I don't know how many years, you know, a long time. And I think it's the Shriners breakfast. So it's sort of a tradition at the fair.
When you think about some of these other photos, I mean, there are people, there's like a little kid who looks like he's getting ready to maybe race or something.
Oh yeah. That was one night, it was like a four wheel race and, you know, it was all ages and his age group. I think he might've won his age group. And, so they go around this track, which was really interesting to see that there's this other culture in Missouri of four wheel racing, you know, and there's all these things that are sort of revealed about Missouri. And so this kid, had just got done racing and he's in his full race gear, looks sort of like a grown up, but a little version of it.
He looks like he's ready to get in a race car, but that's clearly not what he's going to do.
Right.
I mean, when you say that there's this whole tradition of four-wheel racing, can you talk about that? That wasn't at the fair, at least as far as I remember when I was a kid.
Well, there's a racetrack. It's sort of on the outskirts of the fair, so you have to kind of know that it's going to happen. But there's four-wheel racing, motorcycle racing, all types of different racing. And then there's all these contests, too. Like pig, the biggest pig or grandest pig. I'm not sure what they call it. You know, so there's all these traditions and it's people who, you know, do this year round and they come from Missouri and they come and they sort of, they put it on display there.
When you meet people when you're showing people your photographs, mm-hmm. Do you have a lot of viewers who haven't been to a state fair who are totally unfamiliar with the world you're trying to represent here?
It's a good question. I mean, I think people have at least gone once or twice in their life, but definitely not year to year. Like I know some folks do go every year, especially around the Sedalia area. People, you know, they go there every year. And, but, you know, I think it's, people connect with the pictures when I show it to them, and they sort of, you know, they sort of see this representation. They can kind of understand. And, you know, I cast a pretty wide net in the beginning, but after the third or fourth day, I began to like sort of pick people out that I wanted to photograph. And
what made you pick certain people?
It was either, you know, like the way they walked or their smile or their connection with me. And if people sort of tended to ignore me as they walked by, I wouldn't stop them. But if they sort of saw or like were interested, I would say, yeah, come on, let me take your picture.
Have any of the people whose photos you took, have they seen their portraits?
At the opening, there was one woman and one of her really good friends was on the wall. So she, you know, I'm going to get a hold of everyone. I have everybody's email address, so that's still going to happen.
But what was it like for her to see this? I mean, when you talk about that, you're kind of wanting to elevate how people see Missouri and how people right. see the state fair and give a sense of, you know, helping people see the beauty in it.
Yeah. I think, you know, she was saw her friend on the wall and she thought it was, a you know, kind of a good picture of her and really excited. And so I think she took a picture and texted it. And, you know, I'm trying to make everyone bring out their qualities, you know, that I see in them and in the picture. And so
what did you see in this woman's friend?
Her eyes and her hair and sort of, you know, I think she's looking over my shoulder and I sort of directed her in that way. You know, the sort of way people take a picture, have their picture taken, is they smile and look in the camera. And sometimes that's not the best for a portrait. And so I directed her to look sort of over my shoulder and across the street.
Matt Rayner's fair pictures are on view at the Dom Museum in Sedalia through September 2nd. Matt Rayner, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Up next, a Kansas City music phenomenon in the making. He sings and beatboxes while strumming the ukulele. Meet Eames in just a minute. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now Eames, that's E-E-M-S, is a local musician. He started out in the hip-hop scene. But how would you describe the sound of his new EP? We're going with ukulele R&B with a hint of reggae, but that does not fully capture it. Check this out. The song is called Dangerous Game.
What do you mean?
Eames is also known as Philip Jackson, and he's having quite a summer. He dropped a new EP in June, and he just got back from playing a crowd of 3,000. He's with us now to tell the story of how he became his own musician, from surviving hard times on Kansas City's north side to getting into hip-hop and randomly picking up a ukulele. Eames, hello.
Hey.
So tell me about your new EP.
Well, it's called Dreams. The short story is I released a project maybe 4 or 5 years ago called Small Dreams. And basically in that project, I was just saying that the dreams that I was shooting for, a lot of people thought were big. But to the moguls and the icons, the little small dreams I had were just small dreams. So after 4 or 5 years later, it's kind of crazy that I'm actually living those dreams. So I thought it was just a play on words and kind of like a celebration that all my hard work paid off and now I'm finally living those small dreams, which are just dreams now.
What, in what way are you living? Tell me about the small dreams that you are now living.
I mean, we all, as artists, we all, you know, want to actually tour and, you know, do big shows and people buy merchandise. But after doing it for so long, you come into a realization that that may not happen and a lot of people give up. But I don't know, I guess I just persisted and stuck with it and now I'm literally touring and I mean, just doing some crazy stuff, fans all over the world, literally, and it's just out of control.
It's out of control?
It's out of control.
Is that what it feels like to you?
Right now, and I mean, I'm not trying to make it sound like I'm a mogul or anything or I have 10 million fans, but just coming from nothing, it feels good to, you know, be able to tour and do this for a living.
When you say coming from nothing, can you tell me about your background?
Oh, you know, I mean, simple, single-parent household. Went to Kansas City, Missouri School District, Lincoln. Graduated in 2009. just, you know, living in, I guess, I don't want to call it the hood, but the hood, and just, you know, humble beginnings and whatnot. So everything I have, my mom always told me to work hard for it, so I feel like I earned it.
You're from, you've described it as Kansas City's north side, and I'm wondering exactly right. Where you mean.
So it's two different things that people don't understand. There's North Kansas City, which is like north of the river, but what we call the north side is like 27th to about 10th Street. So we call that like the north side, and then there's obviously Midtown and South Side, but yeah, I'm from the north side, 18th and Vine area to be exact.
So you mentioned that you're coming from a single parent household. Can you tell me more about your mom?
Oh, my mom. I guess that's who I have to credit my real music capabilities to. My mom was the youth choir director at church, and I hated singing. I mean, I hated it. My sister, my older sister, Ashley, was actually the singer in the family. She did the whole American Idol thing a couple of times and whatnot. I absolutely hated music until about the age of 9. And fast forward, I was rapping and whatnot, and I guess I have my mama to thank for making me sing. That gave me some vocals.
So wait, when you said that you hated singing and you hated music.
Oh, I hated it.
What did you hate about it?
My sister used to walk around the house literally like, it's kind of like if you got a kid that loves football and he walks around everywhere with that football. My sister walked around the house singing jingles from like Golden Girls and like just walking around the house singing. So I absolutely hated music. I didn't get my first album, my first actual physical copy of music until I was about 13. I hated music. Shout out to when I was about 9, I don't even know how, but I ended up on piano and I kind of ended up liking music through the years.
What was that first album that you got when you were 13?
I believe it was Eminem Encore. It wasn't his last album at the time. It was his last album. I think it was Encore. By Eminem, rap album.
Well, you said you were rapping. Did you consider, you didn't consider that music?
No. I didn't start rapping until I was 16, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So before, I didn't start actually, like, taking music seriously and writing songs. I mean, seriously, until I was about, 16. I met my best friend, Bunny, and he was a rapper. At the time, I was just producing and making beats. And just hanging around him, I started rapping. So, yeah, I didn't start doing that. I was playing piano at 9. I joined the band at school in 8th grade, so that's like, 13? And then I got serious around 16.
So when you say you got serious, can you describe that to me a little bit more?
That's when you pull out your karaoke machine and you start...
That sounds very serious.
Yeah, you pull out the karaoke machine and you start recording demos and whatnot, passing them out. That's when I started like going to school, passing out like CDs to like friends and, you know... here's an interesting story. I was real big on promotion and whatnot. That's always been my thing. So I'm walking around school after school, hanging up pictures of myself in the school, trying to promote my name. The next day, the principal calls me down to the office, and she's like, Phil, I like your music. I love what you're doing, but you can't be hanging up your pictures all over my school or whatever. So that's when I kind of got serious with everything.
When you, though, made this switch from hating music to something like clicked, do you remember how that happened?
Oh, man. I don't. I remember I got my first keyboard when I was 9. And I don't know, I fell in love with piano. I was like real big on classical piano. I could never read music, and I joined the band to learn how to read music at school. I don't know. I guess if I had to just take a guess, all my family does something musical. Like every single last one of my cousins, we all start out on drums. So everybody in my family plays drums. And then you move on to a second instrument, whether it be bass guitar, lead guitar, and that's just kind of how it is in my church. So I may have just been following along with the rest of my cousins. Like everyone plays another instrument, it's time for me to pick up something outside of drums. So it may have just been that. I can't really remember.
I've heard that you kind of joke that you don't rap, you now mostly sing, but that you don't rap because you're too skinny to be a rapper.
I say that. I mean, realistically, when I was rapping, I just never felt like I fit in. So in terms of just everything, not just my size or my look, just the gold chains. And I mean, I'm just using small stuff, like everything. I was performing in clubs since about the age of like 17. Some of my older rap songs was talking about how we in the club and I ain't even supposed to be in here based on our club. But it just, I don't know. I think I got burnt out on the lifestyle because I started doing it when I was like 16, literally being inside the clubs, rapping and whatnot.
Tell me about the lifestyle.
Okay, here's a good example. This is a good question. No one's ever asked me this. So when I was rapping, shows don't start until like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. You don't hit the stage until like 12, 1 o'clock, and the club closes at 3. I hated that lifestyle.
Like, yeah, that's a night. That's
oh
my nightmare.
Gosh. Could you imagine doing that like 2 times a week? Even the open mics was like that. Versus now, I'm hitting stages like, I'm usually like done with a show by like 9, unless it's like a festival. And even then, it's still like 10 or 11. So it's just a different, it's a completely different lifestyle.
So let's see. Your sound now, I mean, how would you describe your sound? I started off with my own kind of attempt at describing it, which was ukulele R&B with a hint of reggae. Does that sound at all fair or like?
Yeah, the only thing I don't agree with, but everyone says this, is the reggae part.
You don't hear it?
I made one reggae song, maybe two in my lifespan, but the amount of people that come up to me and be like, hey, can you play some Bob Marley? Like, I don't know a single Bob Marley song. I don't know a reggae song.
You know, I think that for me, where I heard the reggae is that there's like a lot of upbeat.
Okay.
And then the way that the vocals kind of wrap around it, it's not that it sounds like reggae exactly. It's mm-hmm. that there's something about that upbeat and the way the vocals weave.
Well,
it.
I mean, I'll take it. I'm not complaining. I don't really think, I hate to say this because I think this is terrible marketing, but I don't think I have a genre. I don't set out to be a genre. I don't set out to make folk or singer-songwriter. I rapped on my last album, and I'm not a rapper. On my last EP, I should say. I just make music. So, for example, with Dangerous Game, that's what just came out that day. I was feeling, you know, making type like a reggae type, you know, Latin American type beat. But also you have Pacing for Your Love on the project, which is definitely more radio material. So
totally.
I just
we'll
make
be
music.
Hearing that later.
Dope. Yeah, I just make music.
So you did, though, first get into it through hip hop. And then when did it start kind of diverging in its own direction? Do you remember? I mean, so the big thing is the ukulele.
Right. Well, backtrack a little bit. I wouldn't say I got into hip hop. I definitely say I got into gospel. I mean, I definitely started out, like when I started doing music, it was learning gospel songs growing up in a church. Hip hop happened just naturally. It was the most popular music at the time, I believe, at least in my neighborhood. And I met my friend Bunny. Now, as far as the ukulele,
Wait, can you tell me more about meeting your friend Bunny?
It
seems like an important part of your story. And I don't know Bunny. I need to know more.
Bunny doesn't get enough credit. Bunny, shout out to Bunny. Everybody go look up BUN number 3. Bunny is the 50% of my career. Every video I've ever shot, at least 95% of every music video I shot, Bunny shot for me. All my photo shoots, we kind of came up together since the age of 16, learning the ropes. So we learned videography together, photography, music production, audio engineering. So everything up until maybe like 3 years ago that you had seen from me was 100% Bunny. And vice versa, I did all his stuff. We kind of just helped each other. We were too broke to pay somebody else to do it, so we figured we just get on YouTube and figure out how to do it ourselves. But that's my brother. We actually just shot a music video yesterday. It'll be coming out soon. He shot it for me. But yeah,
but it seems like meeting him put you on a new path.
Definitely. I think it made me get serious. I finally had somebody to, you know, you need a team to be successful in any business that it is. So Bunny was like my support system, and I was his, and we just kind of, you know, fought through the hard times and made it work.
So the ukulele then enters the picture and changes your sound.
Ukulele. The quick story is, so I was rapping, stopped. I didn't stop rapping. I went on tour doing photography for one of my friends, and I seen how much money singers were making, if we're just going to be honest. And I was like, I'm going to sing from now on. I came back and I was like, I'm going to sing. And I originally started looping and playing piano with the iPad. I was Eames the iPad artist. It was my tagline. And it just kind of started developing different sounds, playing with different instruments, different toys. So I was always a guitar center. One day I walk into a guitar center and literally the ukulele's on sale. And I am known for just buying stupid stuff. So I
picked up. That's your claim to fame?
That's my claim to fame. One day, who knows what's coming next. But I get the ukulele. Everyone thinks I'm crazy. I'm walking around in my white tee and baggy jeans with the ukulele. My mom's like, what are you doing? I'm like, just trust me on this one. I play an open mic. and people love it. And I just stick with it. And it kind of just turned into what it is today. I guess it was complete accident.
We're going to listen to some more music in a second. But I do want to say you just got back from a tour about how music helps with mental health struggles.
Right. The tour was it was an East Coast tour. And I played a couple shows in Harlem and some shows in like Rhode Island. But the big reason I came out there was to work with an organization by the name of Peace Love. And they're just real big on using the arts to advocate for mental illness. So a lot of what I do now is actually I go and speak and play and kind of relate my story to different situations. So, yeah.
What is it about your story that makes this personal for you?
You mean the mental illness?
Yeah.
That's actually interesting because the phone calls that I get, I have no idea why I'm getting them. And then they convince me to come out and do the show. But I guess it's kind of like how I combated feeling being different. And I know a lot of people with mental illness, they feel like they're different. And the way I combated being different through rap and whatnot and, was through music. So I kind of just came out and talked about my story and how I got over feeling like I was the outcast. Especially when I first picked up the ukulele, everybody thought I was weird. And I just stuck with it and it worked out for me.
How did people, it sounds like that was maybe a bigger thing than I'd realized. Like, you got really treated like some kind of outsider at that point?
Well, I don't even want to go super in deep into it. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say an outsider, but when you've been doing something since day one and it's fun and it's what everybody does, and then all of a sudden, you know, you want to change up, a lot of people may defer away from you and whatnot. And that happened, you know. But I'm built tough. It is what it is. And at the end of the day, I knew I had something special. You know, when they say it's a thin line between genius and insanity. So some people may be like, that's crazy. But there's a whole other group of people that think that's genius. So I just stuck with it.
Because it felt right to you.
Definitely. Definitely.
You know, you do sing a lot about your struggles, though. And I'm curious about what the struggles are in particular that you think it's important to speak out about. I mean, you became a dad at 18.
Right. I wouldn't call that a struggle. I think I told this story before. I remember when the word got out that I was gonna, you know, have a kid I was a senior in high school, and one of my friends inboxed me on Facebook at the time and was like, "Man, I guess your music career is over. That's it." And I thought that was crazy. To me, that was more of a reason to work harder. I don't have a give up bone in my body. I don't like starting something and not finishing it. The struggles of music, I mean, that really necessarily wasn't a struggle for me, like trying to make it work. I knew it was going to work, at least in my brain. Like, it just, I had to stick with it. My struggle is more so figuring out how to reach the dream. And I more so try to push people to reach their dreams. I know I'm just built like this, and I've always had a dream. My mom always put that in me to, you know, do what you want to do. But I know a lot of people are lost and trying to figure out what they're doing. So my overall message is to pick a dream and chase it no matter what it is.
Okay, well, we already heard one of the songs from your new EP. I want to hear another one. This one is called Makeup on Your Scars.
You don't have to put makeup on your scars. Oh, you're lying. You're among the stars. Fly me to the moon. You don't have to put makeup on your scars.
About the message in the song. We've talked a lot about the sound of your music, but what is it that you're saying in the lyrics, and why do you want to say it?
I mean, this is more so an empowering song. Excuse me. I don't know, when I wrote the song, it's actually the first song I wrote on the album. It's the last song I decided to put on the album, though. I forgot I recorded it and found it and was like, oh, the project's done. But it's mainly just talking about everyone goes through stuff, and we try to, you know, cover up our, you know, mistakes and whatnot. It's okay to be different and mess up, you know, just get back up and try again. Basically the overall message. And as far as, you know, you don't have to put makeup on your scars. I heal all your wounds. I'm really talking about people. if you just listen to the music and just find something inside of my music, you'll be fine. Just find something to make you get over what you're going through, basically.
Talk to me about your live shows. I mean, obviously, we're listening to your recorded music, but your live shows have a life of their own. First right. of all, there's this looping piano with iPad thing.
Well, I don't do that anymore. I started off doing that just because at the time, we're resourceful. I know I wanted to loop and do some live production, but I couldn't afford foot pedals and all the computers and whatnot. Had an iPad, I knew apps were cheap, and so I ran with that. But now I use three different pedals on the ground, and they all, my ukulele and vocals run through them. So I do a lot of vocal processing and whatnot. But my live shows are interesting. I like to think I have one of the best live shows in Kansas City. What I did was, quick story. I got a lot of stories. So I went to Des Moines, Iowa. I knew some people up there, and they invited me out to open up for them. Group by the name of the Brazilian Twins. And at this time, I'm kind of killing the open mics in Kansas City. I feel like I'm the man. And I go to Des Moines, and I bomb the show. I mean, it's terrible. And
can you describe what you mean by that a little?
By my standards, it was great. So I'm on stage thinking I'm rocking, but the crowd's not paying me any attention. So I'm like, what is this? And the Brazilian Twins take the stage. And I immediately realized they had it. Their standard was a lot higher than what I was providing for them. The stuff that they were doing, I didn't think was possible from a local artist. I mean, they were doing things that only Beyonce and Cher were doing, like on stage, as a local artist.
So just like production level, right, that kind of stuff.
Blew my
polish.
Mind.
Polish.
All of that. Blue lights, I mean, everything. Blew my mind. So I talked to them. They taught me some things, and I kind of learned how to actually throw a real show. So when you come to an EAM show, you're not just getting what you're going to think is, oh, another local artist. He's going to get up and sing some songs and tell the story about each song. When you come to an EAM show, you're going to get the smoke machines, the confetti, the lights, the drum line, outfit changes. We got some. I want to set my ukulele on fire. I'm probably going to do that if I play at this year's Plaza Art Fair. Hopefully I do.
Why do you want to set your ukulele on fire? Very specific goal.
I don't know. Fire on stage is cool to me. And I haven't found a venue that's going to let me do it. So I've got to do it at a festival. So it's outside. But I'm just always trying to up the ante and do some new stuff in my show. So I've got some tricks up my sleeve. Like I said, I usually perform with my drill team. I mean, my drum line. And we're going to up the ante to my drill team this year. So you're probably going to see like 30 kids performing with me at a couple shows. I actually brought my drill team out with me at the Kansas City Convention Center.
So wait, drill team, is that something you have a history with?
Oh, yeah. So I joined drill team when I was 21. So maybe about 7 years ago. And I joined the drill team as a drum instructor, fell in love with it. I thought I was going to hate it because I had a band background and drill team isn't really technical, urban drill team. After that, I joined the Kansas City Marching Cobras, which I'm sure everybody in Kansas City knows. I joined the Kansas City Marching Cobras. And after that, I was like, I want to start my own drill team.
What was it like? I mean, as an adult, become part of this. The drill team, it seems like its own world.
It is.
And especially the Marching Cobras.
Right. I want to shoot a movie because it's a hidden art that's across the nation. A lot of people don't know about. There's a drill team society in every state. We travel all over and compete. I joined simply because they needed a drum instructor, it was that. I fell in love with it, though. The kids, the lifestyle, competing against other teams. I mean, it's super competitive. Like, it's really crazy. And just traveling. And I ended up, I was older, obviously, so I ended up the fact that I was teaching kids stuff. So I was like, I want to start my own drill team. So I started Broadway Drill Team maybe 5 years ago, I think in 2013, and we've been up and running. So I've taken my drum line all over the country with me, try to make sure. I got a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 17-year-old, and I just try to make sure they experience different things. They've done meet and greets and signed autographs all over the country. This year, I want to push my drill team out there, so they'll be performing with me quite a bit.
Now that you are touring so much and also taking kids around the country touring, does Kansas City look differently? Like, do you view where you came from differently?
Okay, here's a story. I used to hate Kansas City. I'm not going to say hate, but I think when you're from here, you get tired of it really easy. Like, where's the fun? Okay. But when it's no place like home. I mean, that's the simple way to put it. I've been everywhere and I'm always in a rush to get home. And I wanted to move out of Kansas City. I wouldn't mind staying in Kansas City now. It's a perfect place to raise kids. I mean, it's just a lot of stuff to do here. The thing is, I think we get trapped in where we're at. I never did a lot of different things that was like maybe on the west side of the town. I was always stuck in just my area. But after growing up, and I'm all about experiences, I got big on exploring things. So,
well, we are hearing another song from your new EP. Can you tell me about what we're hearing?
Oh, this is Pacing for Your Love. This song was actually wrote like 4 or 5 years ago too, also. And just kind of revamped it and decided to put it out. I got a lot of music just sitting around, so I'll never run out of material.
This is super poppy.
Yeah, like I said, I don't have a genre. I mean, I listen to gangster rap, to folk music, John Mayer, Ed Sheeran, obviously. So I just make music, and this is one of my favorite songs on the project.
Well, Eames, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Eames is performing at KCUR's next Stockyard Sounds event, July 30th, at the Stockyard Brewing Company. You can go to KCUR's Facebook page for the details. This week's shows were produced by Sylvia Maria Gross, Suzanne Hogan, Matthew Long Middleton, and Coy Duggar, with help from intern Trevor Hook. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. And I'll drop everything, 'cause I love nothing else this much. I do 100 on the highway, missing you. Racing through the night, trying to get to you. Skip up, red light.